are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
And welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous place we call Earth, thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. I'm delighted to be here, and I hope you are too. We're kicking off a brand new week of great shows, and you don't want to miss a single one of them. You miss a single second of a Kevin Smith Show, and you'll miss a universe of information. A couple of quick announcements here that are pretty important. You've been asking about the Gods in the Garden seminar. When will the DVD set be ready? Now, I was notified by Jerry Wills today that all of the editing is done. I've already looked at one cut, one edit of it, and there were some minor changes we had to make. And so those have been done. It is ready to go into production, so you'll be able to get it pretty soon, within a few days, I think. The Ed Grimsley Conference, now you want to remember that. The Ed Grimsley Conference is, it's called the Ed Grimsley Night Vision Skywatch Conference. That's coming up May 22nd through 24th, 2009, in Sedona, Arizona. And in order to get your tickets for that, register for that, you need to go over to UFOSkywatch.com, and you can do all that right there. Also, we have something else that we've several people have written in and asked for. A few nights ago, last week, I did a show on evidence straight from NASA's website where I showed you that evidence right off of their website seems to show they're not exactly telling us all the truth about Mars. And so I've had several people saying, man, I wish I could get my hands on that, on the DVD of that, so that I could watch that and see that evidence again. Okay, we've got it for you. Now, the place to get it is in our online store. You just go over to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, go right up at the top of the page there on the right. You see a link that says visit our store. Click that, and you'll find that DVD in there, all right? Now, you know, one of the wonders of the world, ever since there's been a list about the wonders of the world, listing the wonders of the world, is the Great Pyramid. And it's also one of the most enduring mysteries of the world. There have been so many books written about it and so many articles, DVDs produced, seminars held, all about this wonder of the world called the Great Pyramid. And many of you, over the past several years, as you've called into the show, you've made reference to a book called the Giza Power Plant. You've talked about it. You've talked about how this guy says that that it was probably a power plant. Well, this guy is Christopher Dunn, and Christopher Dunn will be my guest tonight. We're going to be talking about more mysteries about that pyramid than probably most of us have even heard about. When we come back from this break, it will be me, Christopher Dunn, and you. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Christopher Dunn. And Christopher Dunn has a background that I think uniquely qualifies him to say the things that he says and write the things that he writes with regard to the Great Pyramid and other mysteries that he has discovered in ancient Egypt, in the artifacts of ancient Egypt. Over the past 48 years, Christopher Dunn has worked in every level of high-tech manufacturing, from machinist to toolmaker to programmer, operator of high-power industrial lasers, project engineer, and laser operations manager. He is the author of the very popular book, The Giza Power Plant, and he has published over a dozen magazine articles, including an article that has been quoted quite a lot called Advanced Machining in Ancient Egypt. He's appeared in the United States on television, on PAX Television, the Travel Channel, the Discovery Channel, the Learning Channel, Lifetime Television, all discussing his research. And it is our great privilege and pleasure to say, Christopher Dunn, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
Well, thank you, Kevin. Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here, and certainly a great pleasure to speak to your audience.
I noticed in your biographical information that you grew up in Manchester, England.
I did that.
That's the home of that is the home of the mildly popular Manchester United, is it not?
Mildly popular. And fully funded by AIG.
Well, they are a great team. And I'll tell you, I lived overseas for a number of years and learned to love what all the rest of the world refers to as football. Here in America, they call it soccer. But
soccer.
Exactly. All the rest of the world calls it football. And Manchester United is always a major, major contender. Great team.
It is a great team, and it's unfortunate that their colors aren't blue, because I was a City fan when I lived there.
Oh, yeah?
My son is a Manchester United fan.
I see. Well, I won't tell you which fan I've got three teams in international football. I've got three teams that I would have to say are, you know, I don't have just one. I've got three that I'm a real fan of, but Man U is one of them, and they're great.
They are
great. Well, Christopher, how in the world did a guy who's working in the aerospace industry in high-tech machining get interested in the Great Pyramid?
That is an excellent question. And it's the common question, actually, but it really goes back to, I've had a fascination for Egypt for all my life. One of my relatives is actually Egyptian, my sister's husband, and so I've always been attracted by the culture, the antiquity of the country, and also its icons, the artifacts that essentially grace the pages of a lot of National Geographic programs and books. And it was one particular book that I picked up. It was a book by Peter Tompkins, and I was drawn to it because of it was attractive, for one thing, and it addressed a kind of a unique perspective on the Great Pyramid. And that unique perspective was a perspective that actually questioned the orthodox theories and presented alternate theories to the purpose behind the Great Pyramid. And they did it in a way that was very engaging. An air of mystery surrounded it, and it was very easy to get captivated by this book, and it was a marvelous book, and I essentially started to devour it. And over a period of months, it began to dawn on me that there was certainly a lot more to this structure than what I had been taught in school or what was in the popular documentaries put out by conventional Egyptologists. And it was the thing that really struck me, Kevin, about the structure was this precision. And the amazing thing about it was that it had, I would consider to be, the precision of a machine, only on a scale of acres. And to replicate this object, to scale it down to the size of what we consider to be a machine, you would have a highly precise piece of equipment. But more than that, it wasn't just the way it was constructed, the way the blocks were fitted together, and the precision with which it was built, but the design of the Great Pyramid is very unusual. And I try to reconcile the design with the conventional theory, and I found myself asking some very serious questions about the validity of the tomb theory, because it just didn't seem to hang together. It didn't seem to answer or actually provide answers for the evidence within the Great Pyramid.
All right, now you mentioned the design itself suggested to you that it was a very large machine. What is it about the design that says that to you?
Actually, and it's interesting that you tend to you tend to interpret things with what you're familiar with, and so I can understand certainly that Egyptologists, they're looking for tombs, and they see any structure in ancient Egypt, and they would interpret it in the context of it being a tomb. Mm-hmm. And it could be argued that because I've worked with machines and drawings and schematics all my life, what I see is a machine. But if you look at the cross-section of the Great Pyramid, there are features within the Great Pyramid that actually look like the schematics to a machine rather than to a building, because they're inexplicable in their design. That they make no sense in terms of the tomb theory, and because of their unusual angles, the precision with which they were built, it was really very easy for me to start looking at this and wondering, well, if this was a machine, what did the machine do? How did it function? And to answer that question, essentially, it was just a matter of doing some routine detective work and finding answers for all the anomalies within the structure. And there are plenty of anomalies.
Well, now, when we think about a machine, we normally think in terms of it has moving parts.
Yeah.
But the Great Pyramid would not appear to have moving parts.
They would not appear to have moving parts. That is correct. It's a solid statement machine, just like a laser is solid state, and it does not have any moving parts within it. But there is movement. It's very discrete. It's there is movement of electrons, there's movement of light, and there is an output from that interaction. And it's the same with the Great Pyramid. There is movement. We just don't have mechanical movement. It's the movement of sound, vibration, movement of gases within the structure that actually allow it to function.
All right. Now, is it still functioning? Is it outputting electricity.
No, no, it is absolutely defunct right now. The there has been a tremendous damage within one of the principal features within the Great Pyramid, which is the King's Chamber. And the King's Chamber in the Giza power plant is described as a resonant quartzite chamber because it is crafted entirely out of granite, which has 55% silicon quartz crystals. But the design of the chamber is such that it actually does function to a certain degree, not in the sense that there is power generated, but there is a certain amount of resonance still within the King's Chamber or the resonant quartzite chamber. And this was proven by an acoustics engineer who in 1995 did some acoustic tests within the King's Chamber, and he found that it actually did resonate even when there was no external input that he knew about. There were vibrations within this King's Chamber, infrasonic vibrations between 2 and 9 hertz. But the interesting thing about those vibrations that he detected was that they were in the range, or that they formed an F-sharp chord, which is supposedly the same chord that the Hopi Indians tune their pipes to. So it is said to resonate to the frequencies of the earth.
Let's go back in time just a bit. Let's go back to the time when the pyramid would have been functioning and outputting power. Describe for us how it would be generating power. Because when we think about power generation, we're thinking about an input of some type of energy, either a movement or an electrical impulse, something that gets put into the generator for it to use as fuel and then for it to use in the generation of more electricity. So as I understand what you're describing, there would have been no input. So what would cause it to work?
There are some missing pieces. And so taking what is there and then filling in the blank, so to speak, and that is open to interpretation. But taking what is in there, the theory is that energy came through the pyramid, and this was mechanical energy from the earth. It was coupled harmonically with the earth, and it was driven to resonance through equipment in the subterranean chamber. If we describe the pyramid, we have a descending passage which is at a 26 degree angle down to a subterranean chamber, and then a ascending passage which eventually comes to a large open space called the Grand Gallery. And in the Grand Gallery, the Grand Gallery is 28 feet high. It's 80 inches wide at the bottom and 40 inches wide at the top. But the walls are such that they actually step in as it gets higher. In the Giza power plant theory, the missing equipment from the resonator hall is put in place, and that is a series of resonators that were installed along the length of this gallery, and in 27 pairs of slots they were locked into place and converting vibration that was coming through the pyramid to airborne sound. And this airborne sound was then directed into the resonant quartzite chamber, which is commonly known as the King's Chamber. It went through an acoustic filter and then eventually drove the granite to resonance. Now, the evidence, before we go any further than that, we have to look at some of the evidence that led to actually coming to that hypothesis. And there is some empirical evidence. There is some kind of legend, if you will, where there have been reports of people who actually have been in the Great Pyramid and noticed the acoustical effects of the Grand Gallery. And the acoustical effects are that sound generated within the Grand Gallery will bounce around the multiple angles that are formed by the geometry in the Grand Gallery, and eventually they'll focus into the King's Chamber and cause it to resonate. This information comes from Napoleon, whose men were supposed to have discharged their pistols at the top of the Grand Gallery, and the sound was like a rolling thunder that went out into the rolled out into the distance and then resonated in the chamber behind them. Also, Paul Horn, who made a record, he played the flute inside the Great Pyramid, and he noted the same thing. He went out onto the into the Grand Gallery and played his flute, and he found that the resonance in the Grand Gallery was very, very slight. I mean, the reverberation was low, but the sound was resonating behind him, and it was actually going out into the gallery and being focused back into the chamber. So that is some indication that this structure or this internal space was designed for an acoustic purpose rather than just a passageway to take a body up to a burial chamber. It has, you know, otherwise it just is an inexplicable feature of the Great Pyramid.
All right, so what you're describing then is a series of mechanisms that would in essence, amplify sound waves to a point where they would cause the quartz in the composition of the stones to resonate.
Exactly.
Okay. And then as it resonates, then I assume it's giving off electricity?
It would give off, it would act like a thermal acoustic engine. That in my book, I describe it as giving off electromagnetic energy and also ultrasonic energy, and driving a gas to a higher energy level, which would take it to a level where it would actually laze, or there would be a stimulated emission of radiation if a suitable input of energy would affect the energized gas.
All right, we've got a break coming up here in about 20 seconds. And when we come back from this break, Christopher, I would like for you to describe for us how, I mean, if it's generating all of this energy, by what means could that energy be harnessed into some useful purpose? And we'll take this break. When we come back, we'll get into that question. All right, folks, don't go away. We'll be right back with Christopher Dunn and the Giza Power Plant. Welcome back to the show. My guest this evening, Christopher Dunn. And Christopher, when we went away for break, I said I'd like to get you to sort of describe for us, how would you harness this power, this energy that's being produced inside of the Great Pyramid, how would you harness it in order to be able to use it for useful purposes?
Well, that is a very good question. The harnessing of the power would be pretty much the same way that we would do it today if we were to transmit energy wirelessly. And that has been proposed to actually convert the sun's rays to microwave energy and then beam it from a relay satellite to other parts of the planet. Now, that's just, you know, been speculated on how we could do that today. Certainly, we don't know how the ancient Egyptians did it, because as far as the Giza power plant theory, the evidence only takes us as far as the exit shaft of the southern shaft. So everything internally fits within the pyramid or supports the power plant theory. But when you look outside, inexplicably, we don't see the evidence to actually say, yes, okay, they had electrical devices like we did, refrigerators, toaster ovens, microwave ovens, so on and so forth. Some people have even suggested that it may have been a communication device, so that that energy was not harnessed for useful purposes on Earth, but was actually used as a beacon and beamed out into space. It's an open subject, and I don't have the complete answer to it.
Do you know of anyone who has taken your concept and built perhaps a small scale model of this pyramid to do an experiment to see if it would generate energy?
There is an engineer in Washington by the name of John Cadman, and he modeled the subterranean chamber and proved that it would function as a hydraulic pulse generator. And the fascinating thing about this man's work is that he was like the Close Encounters of the fourth kind, where Richard Dreyfuss building a mounting in his living room out of mashed potatoes. He was up at 3 o'clock in the morning carving the subterranean chamber out of modeling plastic, and he built this device that actually was an exact model of the subterranean chamber. He piped it, he put some valves on it, and he demonstrated that with a flow of water going through it and a wastegate with the gravity and the fall of water, that the chamber would actually resonate and beat just on its own without anything but water flowing through it. And I went to his home to witness the demonstration of it, and I was extremely impressed by it, because the whole ground shook. They had the piping going underneath the earth. And walking across the pipe as this thing was functioning, it was it made the ground shake, and it was impressive. So that's one part of the Great Pyramid that somebody said, you know, I think this part functioned a particular way, and then he actually demonstrated it. The other parts of it, as far as modeling the interior of the Great Pyramid and replicating some of the features within, there is currently work being conducted to model it in the computer and do a finite element analysis to see how acoustics function within the Great Pyramid.
Well, that's very very interesting, because within the last couple of weeks I've had a guest on this show talking about having discovered that there was once a moat around the entire Giza Plateau, and discovered the sluice gates and the slots for the sluice gates and so forth for bringing water into this moat. So it you put that together with what you just said, and perhaps that is their water supply that they used to do as this experiment did.
Well, underneath the Giza Plateau and the pyramids that dot the Giza Plateau is a network of tunnels, and some of the shafts that go down to these tunnels show sign of water erosion. There are some areas to the southeast of the Great Pyramid where you get down into the valleys where there are certainly indications that there was water flowing. And there's one area particularly where there's this really unusual block sticking out of a wall that just looked like a sluice gate. So we may be looking at the same thing, but there's definitely a lot of water flowing on the Giza Plateau at one time.
All right, now, this, of course, begs the question, how old is the Great Pyramid really? Now, before you answer it, I'll go ahead and tell you that I don't buy the idea that the so-called ancient Egyptians built those pyramids, the three on the Giza Plateau, the three big ones. And I don't primarily because if you take the tools that, it's a very simple challenge, take the tools that were available to them and go cut a granite block. You can't do it.
Well, that is that's a very good point that you bring up, Kevin, because that is the subject of my next book, more focused. The Giza Power Plant does deal with that in part in some chapters on how they were able to cut a lot of these blocks. And the interesting thing is that what we are expected to believe is that a civilization sprung up in Egypt and lasted for 3,000 years, and they started out cutting granite blocks using stone tools and copper chisels, and they ended up 3,000 years later cutting blocks with stone tools and copper chisels. Over 3,000 years, they had not advanced their technology one bit. That doesn't make sense. And then when you look at the brilliance of the artifacts that they actually created, and then you start to look at it really closely at some of the precision and the tool marks that you find on the granite blocks in the pyramids and also in the temples, on the statues, you don't see marks of copper chisels. You don't see marks of stone axes or stone chisels. You see very, very precisely cut surfaces, some of them within 2/10,000ths of an inch of flatness and with precise geometry, some surfaces very complex geometry, and this is not the work of primitive workers. It's not the work of the Egyptian toolbox just did not have the tools capable of building this pyramid or the other pyramids and many of the artifacts that we find over there.
Well, it was several years ago, and I really can't remember at this point which guest it was, but I had a guest on the show that was arguing for the standard explanation, being that these ancient Egyptians in the Pharaonic period built these pyramids. And I said, and I still say, he was talking about how they would cut these stones and then float them down the Nile and then, you know, use logs and put them on these logs and drag them up to the pyramid site and so forth. That takes more faith than the most religious person on this earth can muster. And here is why. I said, okay, If you think that's how they did it, go do it.
Brilliant. Yeah, that's exactly that's the test. And the thing is, the interesting thing is that they go ahead and do it, but mm-hmm. they don't replicate the most difficult aspects of the work. In other words, they'll try and demonstrate how they quarried and cut an obelisk and erect an obelisk, but the obelisk is only 9 tons or 25 tons, and the obelisk that the ancient Egyptians worked with weighed 500 tons. So they don't actually replicate the most difficult aspects of the work. They give up. And there was a few documentaries where they had to employ modern tools to complete the task.
Mm-hmm.
And but you didn't see that on the documentary. So yeah, they'll say, well, I can demonstrate that they were able to cut a hole in granite using a copper tube, and nobody's arguing that you can take a copper tube and you can abrade a piece of material using sand. There's no argument that you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't compare it to the original, and the originals do not even. Look like their results. I don't know whether it's a sleight of hand that they're trying, or they're trying to pull the wool over our eyes, or whether they just honestly believe it. It's amazing to me that they can still support that idea.
Well, my challenge to standard Egyptology is the same as it was from the beginning, and that is, okay, do it.
Yes.
Just do it. It cannot be done by us today. And even with our modern technology, you maybe could construct sort of the Great Pyramid, but it would be excessively difficult and excessively expensive. And, you know, just taking the smallest stones that are in the pyramid, the smallest ones are right at the top. All right, carry those up there.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do it?
Yeah, see, the arguments to supporting the traditional methods really fall apart when they try to put them into practice, because you have small stones at the top of the pyramid, but then you have 70-ton blocks of granite in the center of the pyramid, which is 200 feet up in the pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
And how do they get those up there? You know, there's so much to this that you just can't solve the problem sitting in an armchair.
All right, we have to take another break. We'll be back right after this, and I want to talk about the possibility that lasers may have been used in the construction of that pyramid. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest, Christopher Dunn, the author of The Giza Power Plant. Christopher, you are uniquely, I would say, qualified to talk about the possibility that lasers were used in the construction of that pyramid. Now, I've had people on this show, and I've seen documentaries where they show some grooves cut into some stones that they say was done with laser precision. What do you say?
I say no. If lasers were used in the construction of the Great Pyramid, they would have worked very well to align the Great Pyramid. As far as a cutting tool for stone, it is not the tool that I would select. Because when you consider what it is, the laser is actually a thermal process. So it burns material.
Mm-hmm.
By elevating the temperature and causing an exothermic reaction if used with oxygen or air. The of course, granite was would just laugh at it. I mean, you may be able to affect it in some way, but you're not going to achieve the surface finishes or the precision that we find on the granite artifacts in the King's Chamber and on the Giza Plateau or elsewhere throughout Egypt.
Do you have a theory about how they did it?
There is evidence that they had developed tools to match their job. They had built a mega machine, but they were using mega machines to build it. I recently had an article published in Atlantis Rising, and it was called "The Megasaurs of the Ancient Egyptians." And I found evidence at Abu Rawash that shows that they used saws to cut their stone, and these saws were around 34 feet in diameter.
These were power saws?
I would certainly say that they had knowledge to generate power, and they used it in very creative ways. The Great Pyramid kind of indicates that to me. And then when you look at the work that they are able to accomplish, and it certainly supports that idea. Also, there is some evidence that indicates that they were using some kind of vibratory force in their drilling process. It could have been in the ultrasonic range or in the or even lower frequencies, but they were using some kind of vibratory application on their drills when they were drilling granite.
All right, now what is it that indicates that to you?
This was actually described in William Flinders Petrie's book, Secrets of the Pyramids and Temples of Egypt. It's a book that was published in 1883. So William Flinders Petrie was a British Egyptologist, the first British Egyptologist, and he studied some cores and holes that had been cut at granite. They did core drilling. It was kind of like a cookie cutter where you cut the center out and then leave the hole, except this cookie cutter was cutting granite at a rate of 50 to 80 thousandths per revolution of the drill. So as for each rotation of their drill, it sank into the granite about a 16th of an inch. Petrie said it was a 100 thousandths of an inch that it sank into the granite, but my measurements of it indicated that it was a spiral with a pitch of about 50 to 80 thousandths. So that is an anomalous feature that is not explained by conventional machining. It's not explained, certainly not explained by the use of primitive ways of cutting holes, such as bow saw, bow drills, and things of that nature. So this kind of prompted me to suggest that they were using an ultrasonic kind of process where the drill oscillated up and down, and then the grooves or the spiral grooves were created by a rotary action to it, so that as it vibrated and removed the material, it rotated at the same time, causing the spiral. I'm sorry?
Do we have such technology as that?
Yes. Yes, we have. There are sonic core drills that they use today, and they're also they also have these. They have ultrasonic drilling or ultrasonic machining, impact machining. And a lot of those processes, though, the ultrasonic part, it leaves a very smooth surface, and it has a, you can actually machine with ultrasonics complex geometries or cross sections with tools that don't actually rotate, but they will leave their shape inside a material like a ceramic or even a stone or granite. In fact, the NASA had developed an ultrasonic drill that they had taken to Mars, and the uniqueness of their ultrasonic drill is it didn't require much power, and it didn't require much pressure, but just put against the rock, it kind of melted into the rock, melted the rock away. I definitely think that they had some advanced technologies that they were using. You know, when you see some of the work that they performed on site, it really confirms that suspicion. Now the saw at Abu Ruwash, we see other evidence to support that, and that the evidence to support that is a compound curve on a piece of granite that actually shows the feed lines of the saw. And it's a compound radius. In other words, you've got a radius that is terminated in the granite block, and you can see a radius on two axes. So it's and then calculating what the radius is, and you can actually determine what the diameter of the saw is.
All right. Now, what happened to all this high technology?
I think my suspicion, and I think, you know, pretty much everybody that I've talked to who discusses ancient Egypt with the view that there was has been a lost culture, or there was a culture that existed prior to what we know as the ancient Egyptians, that there was some cataclysm that caused the demise of the civilization, and so, you know, massive upheavals on the planet. And even the Great Pyramid itself shows signs that some event caused the destruction of the internal functions of the Great Pyramid. There was an event that happened that caused the King's Chamber to expand over an inch, and there was a conflagration within the Great Pyramid where you can see scorch marks on the limestone ceiling in the Grand Gallery, and then there's also vitrification in the on the granite in the King's Chamber. So there's a lot of destruction around Egypt. You see like the Pyramid of Meidum, the collapse of a lot of these pyramids that really seem rather very robust in their construction, but for some reason they basically collapsed or were vibrated apart. They give me the impression that there was a tremendous forces moving through the planet that caused the demise of that civilization. Could have been a comet strike, because they have found an impact crater in southern Egypt at Kabir. It's difficult to say. I mean, there's evidence also that there was a tsunami that visited that area through the Mediterranean at one time.
But it would seem, though, that we would, as the archaeologists are digging up tombs and, pardon me, as they're digging up tombs and copper tools and kitchen utensils, that somewhere out there they would dig up some of this high technology. Do you think maybe they have, and they have hidden it away?
Well, I wouldn't go that far, because I mean, I don't really have any evidence to support that speculation. The absence of this kind of technology is a real puzzle to me.
Okay, we have to take a break. We'll get the rest of that thought when we come back, and we'll do some flash messages and then open up the phone lines. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Thank you. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and to my guest this evening, Christopher Dunn. And Christopher, we had to go away for break, and you'd just begun answering about the, you know, where are the artifacts of these advanced tools. And I had to cut you off, so I want to give you the floor and let you answer.
Yeah, that's it. One of the most vexing questions that I'm asked frequently, that the tools did not survive, and so, you know, the question then is, well, where is the evidence of the machines? We do have evidence of stone tools, but there are no machines. And the evidence is in the artifacts themselves, that the artifacts could not be produced any other way, and the primitive tools don't satisfy the evidence. They don't replicate it. So we have to assume that some tools had to have existed. For instance, the lathe. The lathe is supposedly a modern invention, yet there are as evidence that the ancient Egyptians used very sophisticated lathes to turn bowls and other artifacts. So they certainly had the machines. They just did not survive the years. Now, today, most of our machine tools are made out of ferrous materials, which over time would rust away. And really, it depends on the number of years, the intervening years, the number of years it would take to actually for these things to disappear from the face of the earth.
What would you say about the theory that the reason those tools, the artifacts of the tools, are, let me just say, the tools, the reason we're not finding the tools is because they came here from somewhere else and were used by people who are not from Earth and were taken with them when they left?
I think that is has a certain plausible ring to it, too. So, you know, I mean, but I mean, that's not a very popular answer either with Egyptologists or those who look for evidence of extraterrestrial visits. But I don't discount anything. I think that, you know, obviously the tools went somewhere, and if they didn't stay on the planet, or if they really should be in the archaeological record, if they had stayed on the planet, then they were probably carried off somewhere else.
All right, we have a question from the United Kingdom here. This is from Susan, and she says she would like to know what you think of Jean-Pierre Houdin's theory that the Great Pyramid was built using an inner ramp and a complex counterweight mechanism in the Great Gallery.
Well, I think the idea of using the pyramid, the mass of the pyramid, as a ramp is a valid theory. I'm not convinced that it was roofed over or entirely internal. I think it could have been accomplished and then finished off from the top on down, where the ramp was actually filled in, rather than just left as a tunnel, if you will, up to the top of the pyramid. As far as the theory that the Grand Gallery was used to counterweight the blocks in the King's Chamber, I don't believe that to be true. I don't think that was the reason for it.
All right, from Australia, let's see, this is from Alex, and he references something called the Tayuba Prophecy. I don't know if you're familiar with it, by Michel Desmarquet, and it gives information about the pyramids. It says they were built about 12,000 years ago by extraterrestrials. Stone cutting was done by something like ultrasonic technology. Lifting was done by levitation. Only a few people knew how to do that. And they were used as antennas for telepathic communications with other worlds and for cloud control. And he says, later the pyramids went out of alignment and became useless for these purposes. All right, what do you think about that?
Well, I think the use of ultrasonic tools is certainly fits within my paradigm. The as far as the use of the pyramid, I see it as more practical application on Earth for more materialistic application, though. I think it does have some holistic and harmonic kind of benefits to the planet and to the people living on the planet. Other than that, you know, I'm not familiar with the prophecy.
All right. Tell you what, let's do. You and I will continue to chat, and we'll open up the telephone lines so that folks can give us a call. If you have a question or a comment for Christopher Dunn, the telephone number is 602-539-9580 or toll-free at 888-223-4599. Again, the toll-free number, 888-223-4599. If you're outside of Canada and you're outside of the United States, you can call the telephone numbers and they will work. But if you don't want to make a long international long distance call, you can use our flash message feature, and you do that by simply going over to my website and click where it says flash message, and then we'll be able to read what your question or comment is. Okay. All right, let's go to the telephone line. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, my name is Avi, and I'm calling from Caldwell, New Jersey.
Okay, Avi, speak up good and loud for us. We're barely getting you.
Okay, can you hear me a little better now?
I can hear you better. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, hi, Kevin. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, I was curious about the what you were saying about the are there any artifacts that might have been left, where are they? I was on someplace on a website called KeelyNet. It talks about the work of John Keeley, and there was something about strange metal forks, tuning forks. They looked like they ranged from 8 inches to 9 feet in length. They say that, I don't know, it's anecdotal, but I thought that was pretty interesting. They were.
And where were these found?
Well, let's see. It said it was discovered by Egyptologists who were unable to ascribe utility to the items. Then they deemed them to be anomalous, and that's really all the information I found on this.
All right. Christopher, are you familiar with those?
I accessed the same webpage and read a report on that, and they were supposedly locked in a room in the Cairo Museum.
So, okay, and have you seen a picture of those, Christopher?
I have not. It's a very tantalizing piece of information, but I have not seen them or any photographs of them.
All right. Avi, thank you so much for the call. Let's go to this next caller. And caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? Hello, caller. Okay, that one is gone. The telephone number is 602-539-9580 or toll-free at 888-223-4599. Now, when you call, let me explain for those of you who don't know. When you call, if the line is open, it's going to either put you online, we won't hear you, but you'll hear us, or it's going to put you on hold, and you'll hear music. If you hear music, don't hang up. If you hang up, you lose your spot, and someone else will be in there, okay? All right, Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? All right, that caller is gone. I don't know what it is. There are people who call in, and if they hear music, they go away. But that's the way the system works, folks. That is how it works. The telephone number is 602-539-9580 or toll-free at 1-888-223-4599. Okay, caller, if you go away, I'm going to block your number. All right, let's see. Let me click this, and here we go. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
You're not going to block me, are you, Kev?
If you hang up again, yes.
It's Kevin from North Bay, Ontario. I don't know what's wrong with the phone system. I was waiting on hold. You answered the phone. You said, hello. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. I said my name. You asked, hello?
Yeah, we couldn't hear you. Okay, what's your question, Kevin, or your comment?
Well, hello, Mr. Dunn. I've done a lot of research on this on the ancient world. One of my main sources, I have to admit, is Zechariah Sitchin. But I seem to have made a connection about these ancient tools that they may have used as a power, not only as a power system, but likely also as probably some sort of data storage when it comes to the compute to the pyramid. It's only a theory that I've made, but you know the 27 niches that were in the Grand Gallery, according to from the research I've done, there were crystals that were used some sort of like rainbow colors from a lot of the different texts and whatnot. I think I may have made a connection between those and the crystal skulls that people have been talking about, these ancient crystal skulls. And I think they may actually have been the crystals that have been used to power that those pyramids.
And that's a connection to the crystal skulls. I don't know. I think that's an interesting possibility. I know that there were reports of glass that would bend and not break. Some of the early reports, and there have been speculation that there were crystals within the Grand Gallery, and certainly the crystals within the King's Chamber are significant too, and those are embedded in the granite.
All right, Kevin, thanks for the call, and caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hello, Kevin, it's Mike from Kentucky.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Mr. Dunn, how are you?
Hi, Mike.
I happened to belong to a group years ago that actually made the trip to Egypt and did vowel sounds inside the King's Chamber, so I know of what you speak.
Good.
And I have a question. We look at the enormous statues of the pharaohs that are sitting or standing outside the temples of Egypt. How do we know those weren't replicas of life-size beings?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Yeah, I said the statues that you see outside the temples of Egypt, the large 40-footers, how do we know that they are not replicas or statues of the actual beings who may have built these pyramids?
Oh, I see. I seriously doubt that they were, because when you go inside the temple, the doorways are really not that tall. So if you would go into the Luxor Temple and through to the Holy of Holies, you certainly, if you're a 40-foot human being, you won't be able to fit through the door. I think they were normal-sized people. That's my personal feeling.
Well, and there's another thing too, Mike. Take Ramses, and there's these 40-foot carvings of Ramses, and yet we've got Ramses' body, his mummy, and so we know exactly what size he was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my idea here was that if there were a race of giants who could have constructed those, it would have been a lot easier to handle those blocks for somebody that size.
Well, yeah, it would be. And you know, every ancient civilization on this planet talks about there being a race of giants. And explorers who came to the New World, Captain Cook, for instance, put it in the ship's logbook that they saw and encountered giants and that he had one captive. It was on his ship, tied to the mast. He broke the mast, jumped overboard, and swam to shore, and they never saw him again. And
you know that the Greeks are full, their history is full of titans.
Mm-hmm.
Big.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Interesting stuff. Yeah, the there is a lot of speculation, as you well know, Christopher, that perhaps there was a race of giants that built these great massive pyramids, and this race is just no longer here. I think it's interesting.
I wouldn't use the statues as a measure for those people, though, because you have 40-foot statues, you also have 20-foot statues, and life-size statues. So
yeah.
But speaking of Ramses, if I could, just for a minute, the Ramses statue have some very significant clues to the technologies that the ancient Egyptians had, and that is the subject of my next book, which will be published next year. So the look for some startling new evidence on the Ramses statues.
Oh, okay, well, that whets my appetite a little bit. All right, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and from where are you calling?
Hi, this is Bob from California.
Hi, Bob.
Hello,
Hello
Mr.
Bob.
Smith and Mr. Dunn.
Hello?
I had a quick question, and then I was going to hang up.
All right.
My question would be, once I heard, I think I read it somewhere, that 90% of all the gold that's been uncovered is within 10 feet under the soil. How much ancient technology is buried and hidden in the Egypt area that's yet to be uncovered? Thank you.
All right.
Good question. If you would pay attention to Zahi Hawass, who is the chairman of the Supreme Council of Antiquities, he would say that 90% of the Egypt's treasures are still under the sand.
90%?
There is a considerable amount yet to be discovered. Hopefully some machine tools.
Well, that would, I really wonder if we would ever see those machine tools, if they discovered them, but hopefully they will discover them. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, this is Jerry. I'm calling from Phoenix.
Hi, Jerry.
I had a question. It's a fascinating show. I missed part of it, but I wanted to ask this question in case I missed it or in case it's pertinent. There was a fellow that I met several years ago, maybe 20 years ago, who told me something about the rods of Amun-Ra, which was a unit of measurement. And it was about the same time I was interested in pyramids. And from that point, I discovered that there was a fellow in, well, I don't know where he was at. I think he was in Europe somewhere. But he made wooden pyramids, and you would put your razor blade in there to sharpen your razor blade. So those are two things I was wondering if your guest has ever heard of and could speak to.
Okay. Christopher?
Yes, I think the it was a Drawl who crafted the pyramid and sharpened razor blades in it. As far as the rods of Ra, I'm not familiar with that, so I can't really speak to that.
Okay.
Well, but as far as the... As far as the effects on the sharpening razor blades, that has been, I mean, that has its supporters and its detractors. It depends what work you read. If you read some works, if you read some of Patrick Flanagan's work, he performed some work in that area, and then there's also... some detraction of the theory where people try it and they can't get it to work. So, It's an open question in my mind.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it. I wanted to get your opinion on it because I really don't know, but it's fascinating to me. Always has been.
All right, Jerry. Thanks for the call.
Always been a certain energy about the pyramids that have attracted people and attracted me too.
All right, we may have time to get one more call in here before our next break. We'll try. 602-539-9580 or 888-223-4599 if you want to call the toll-free number, 888-223-4599. I think from the variety of questions and comments that we've gotten so far, I think that just sort of underscores what I said. The Great Pyramid, not only is it one of the wonders of the world, but it's one of the enduring mysteries of the world. All right, caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hello, Kevin. This is Kevin from Northern Alberta calling.
Hi, Kevin.
Hi. I'd like to ask Chris if they're doing any more exploration inside the Great Pyramid that he's aware of.
I'm not aware of any current investigation. I know that there has been a kind of hanging out there for several years now, the interest in doing further explanation in the southern shaft coming from the Queen's Chamber. And Zahi Hawass was actually inspecting robots from different universities. I think one was a English university, the other one a Singapore university, to select one that would actually do the work. But as far as the work being performed, I'm not aware of anything right now.
Okay. What does Zahi say about the machining that's evident around the pyramid? What does he claim about that?
Actually, you know, when I have visited Zahi on a couple of occasions, and he's been very cordial, but he is the kind of guy that I don't think you could sit around and have a drink with him and talk about advanced machining in ancient Egypt. He's not open to any kind of speculation other than the conventional theories.
All right, we have to take a break. We'll be back, and we'll open up the phone lines for you when we come back. We'll do that again. And you can call in with your questions or your comments for Christopher Dunn. We'll be back right after this. We are back. A couple of quick reminders here. Don't forget that, if you're interested in attending, and I certainly hope you are, attending the Ed Grimsley Night Vision Skywatch Conference in Sedona, Arizona, May 22nd through 24th, go over to UFOSkywatch.com, UFOSkywatch.com, and that's where you get your tickets, make your reservations for that, and so forth. So be sure you do that. It's going to be a great, great time. All right. Also, don't forget, if you wrote to me, you sent me an email, and you said, man, I really wish I could get that show on DVD, the one you did about NASA's evidence. It's here. And just click the link up on the right side of my website that says our online store, and you can get it there, and we'll send it right out. We've got them made up and ready to go. All right, back to our guest, and back to let me open up the telephone lines here again. If you have a question or a comment, we want you to be able to talk with our guest, and so the telephone number is 602-539-9580 or toll-free 1-888-223-4599. If you're outside of the USA, you're outside of Canada, you don't want to pay for that international long-distance call. You can, or you can use Skype, and you can call those numbers, and you know that'll just cost you a penny or two, and then you can talk to us. But if you don't want to do that, you can use a flash message. Go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, scroll down, and underneath Chris's picture, you'll see a link that says flash message. Click that, send me a flash message, it will come to me, and I will read it on the air, and we'll ask Christopher to respond to that. Now, we have one from the Netherlands, from Anthony, and it's pretty long, so let me summarize. Chris, he brings up the Coral Castle, built by Edward Leedskalnin, and Edward Leedskalnin was an immigrant from Latvia, little bitty guy, and he cut these big blocks weighing tons out of a type of coral, old coral that's been packed by years and years and centuries of pressure, and built this castle, the Coral Castle, and no one ever saw him using tools to do it, and no one ever saw him in how he moved those stones from the seaside to where he built the castle. And then he moved the castle some 10 miles away and reconstructed it. What do you know about that, if anything?
Actually, there's a chapter in my book on the mystery of the Coral Castle. And if the listener wants to go to my website, which is geezerpower.com, and scroll down to the bottom, there is an article that deals with the mystery of the Coral Castle. And Edward Leedskalnin actually was one of the few people, or actually the only person in my view, that claimed that he knew how the secrets of how the pyramids were built, and then actually did some work that was believable in the feat of moving these huge blocks of coral. The largest block that he moved was a 30-ton rock, but he also moved an obelisk that was weighted at 22 tons. The total weight throughout his facility at Homestead, Florida, was probably around over 1,200 tons that he had moved into place over the years. Single-handedly, didn't allow anybody to watch him work, was a recluse, very interesting fellow, but basically he was eccentric to the extent that he wanted to hold his secrets close to his chest, so he wouldn't allow anybody to watch him work. Though there are some legends of school children observing him floating stones in the air, but obviously hearsay and unsupportable. And he took the secret to his grave with him. But it's a fascinating place. If you're ever in Miami and want to drive about 30 miles south on Route 1 to Homestead and visit his place, it's a fascinating place to go. And wonderful people down at Homestead. But my website has a bunch of photographs of the castle, the different blocks that he had cut and moved into place.
Well, I think there are two things about Edward Leedskalnin that really make me think that he actually had discovered the secret of how the pyramids were built. One, and he said that. He said that it's easy if you know the secrets of the pyramid builders. But one thing is when he moved that castle, he used a local guy that had a flatbed truck to move some of it. But when the guy would come and to pick up a block, he would park his truck, and Edward Leedskalnin would tell him to go stand behind this hedge where he couldn't see, and he would load the block. There was no machinery no cranes, nothing like that. The guy would go stand behind the hedge, and then, you know, like a minute or two, Lead Scotland would call him to come back to the truck. He would come back, and there's the block on the back of the truck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Fascinating. And then another thing is Lead Scotland published a small booklet on the secrets of magnetism. And I wonder if there's something having to do with magnetism that was the secret behind how he moved those.
I think there's something to that, and I actually made that speculation in my book, because we tend to approach gravity as or anti-gravity as something that is exotic and steeped in physics, which it may be, but there could be a simple solution to it. He may have happened upon a technique for lifting these blocks that actually reduce the weight of them to some degree. And I propose that they were using some kind of a flywheel in his shop, and he was broadcasting a frequency to receptors or radios, receivers on the top of these tripods that you see gathered around his place, and that he was actually using electromagnetism and also vibration to cause a reversal in the poles, because as you mentioned, his theory on magnetism was that all matter was magnetic. It had north and south poles, and that these north and south, these individual magnets, he called them, were streaming from the Earth and actually caused what we know, what we call gravity. Well, he may have been incorrect scientifically, but he using that concept, I think he stumbled onto something. And this secret that he stumbled onto, he didn't want to share with anybody, and so he took the secret to his grave. But it's an inscrutable feat of heavy lifting and engineering that he accomplished. When you look at the chains, he has some chains hanging in his workshop, and the chains are only about 3/8 of an inch thick on the linkage, which would not be rated. They're probably rated to lift something like no more than 10 tons. And he lifted a 30-ton block. And, you know, the thickness on a link to lift a 30-ton block would have to be about 1 inch, not 3/8 of an inch. So it's a, you know, there's a lot of, I would say, red herrings laying around mm-hmm. his place. And probably put there intentionally to throw people off, because he didn't want them to know the real reason why he was doing it. Now, the other interesting aspect to it, he has a very funny little book. It's called A Book for Every Home, in which he writes on what every other page. And it's a fascinating book, but he is writing or telling you how to raise a young lady. I don't know whether he's using that as a metaphor or what, but you have a page of text, and then on the opposite page there is a blank page. And he says that if you disagree with what's written in his book, he's left you as much space so he can write your own opinion. So, you know, we need some Champollion to decipher that book and figure out what he was doing, I think.
Do you think that book is sort of a coded message for the methods that he used?
I wouldn't put it past him. I certainly wouldn't put it past him, because, you know, he was a really odd fellow, and he had a very strange way about him, and he didn't trust anybody. He had a lack of trust. Of course, he was from Latvia, and you know, he he always believed that the Tsars would eventually take over again and ruin his life. So he was very distrustful of the government too, which was why he didn't want his secret to get into government hands.
All right, Bob from Australia, could you please ask Chris, what does he think about the alignments with the constellation Orion and the pyramids? Does he think that could be where the power is coming from cosmic energy of sorts?
I think that there are some correlations with the star group of Orion. I'm not sure whether it's been proven to be intentional or not. And when you consider that the shaft that actually is pointing to Orion is not always pointing to Orion, because the Earth is rotating and moving at a different rate. So there are probably a lot of stars out there that it lines up with at one point or other in its travels across the sky.
Now, but what about the alignment of the pyramids themselves? The three large pyramids there on the Giza Plateau are in the same configuration as the belt.
It's offset, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting observation, and I would say that it's an interesting theory. It certainly captured the imagination of a lot of people.
All right, what about ley lines? We've had quite a number of shows here where people, guests, have come on and talked about ley lines, energy lines in the Earth, and that there are major ley line intersections right on the Giza Plateau. Do you think that would have anything at all to do with the pyramid and generation of energy? But we'll have to get that answer when we come back from break. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Don't go away. Welcome back. My guest this evening is Christopher Dunn. And Christopher, when we went away for break, I just asked a question, but we have a caller on hold. And what I would like to do is bring that caller up online, because he or she has been holding for some time now during the break. So, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. This is Rick from Kentucky.
Hi, Rick.
Mr. Dunn, you mentioned that in one of the halls, it resonates at between 2 and 9 hertz, which is a very low frequency. That's the same type of frequency the Navy communicates with its submarines. I don't know if you're familiar with the Project HARP. Have you heard of that?
Yes, I've heard of it. I'm vaguely familiar with it. I'm not an expert by any means.
Yeah, it's some type of antenna array that transmits at that low frequency. And nearby towns, it created some problems in some houses, and they had some problems with it, but I thought that was interesting that the low frequency could indicate it was some type of communication device. And another thing I found interesting was you said that it resonates at the frequency of an F-sharp chord. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Jerry Wills might be interested in this. That F-sharp chord, I wonder if it corresponds to the tones that he uses at the gates of the gate of Aramuro, or whatever it's called. if that F-sharp chord could similarly be part of that tone. I think you'll understand.
Yeah, there are frequencies. There are frequencies within that that actually resonate with the DNA too, according to Susan Alexander, who is a musicologist and composer. Yeah. So there's definitely a correlation there, and it's in harmony with not just the planet, but also the human body.
Yeah, it seems to be. It's just not obvious to us what it is. I'm glad y'all talked about the Coral Castle. That's one of my most interesting things to research on. It's very interesting.
Rick, I have a question for you.
Yes.
I'm sorry, Chris, I talked over you. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. I was just commenting. It's a fascinating place. I'd recommend anybody, take a trip down there and visit.
Yes.
Okay, Rick, I have a question for you. I can't remember. I think you've told me what your background is. Is it in electronics?
Yes, that's right, Kevin.
Okay, so I have a question. Now, this extreme low frequency.
Mm-hmm.
We know that the extreme low frequencies travel well underwater, but what about for transmitting into space? Do these extreme low frequencies travel well in space?
They should. Not only do they travel well underwater, the main reason low frequencies use is it'll travel over a long distance. High frequencies tend to be more line of sight, such as television, radio, and whatever, and the higher the frequency gets, such as up into cell phone range, they don't have a very far range at all.
Okay, so if this Great Pyramid was, as Chris, you mentioned, perhaps some sort generating power for some sort of communications, and if it is at that frequency, I mean, that frequency would sort of corroborate deep space communication for this pyramid, would it not? What do you think? Are you still there, Rick?
Kevin.
Yeah.
I think it would, Kevin. This is Rick.
Uh-huh.
What do you think, Chris?
I think the communication, if there's energy going out into space, I think it's of a higher frequency because of the use of hydrogen within the Great Pyramid and the frequency of hydrogen. But the feedback to the Earth and the transmission of energy through the Earth in the form of sound or vibration. I think that's where you get a coupling with the vibration of the pyramid and the planet. So,
so is there a higher concentration of hydrogen inside the pyramid than there is outside?
Well, the Queen's Chamber, as we look at some of the historical information on it, actually had a layer of salt that built up over an inch, and there were certain features within the Queen's Chamber that caused me to believe that they were using hydrogen, and they had created a hydrogen maser. This is because of the residual substances in the Queen's Chamber, the shafts that came to the Queen's Chamber, but not quite connected with it, were feeding chemicals or solutions into the chamber, which mixed and created the hydrogen. It boiled off, interacted with the calcium carbonate in the limestone, and leached out salts that gathered on the wall. There's also some evidence within the shafts that this may have been going on. Then if we go to the King's Chamber, which is further up, where the energy was being generated, they have the dimensions of the northern shaft. The width and the height seem to resemble a waveguide with dimensions that are would be suitable for a wavelength of hydrogen, which is 8.309 inches or 21 centimeters.
So everything about this looks to you like they were generating hydrogen. What would they have used this hydrogen for?
Well, the hydrogen as a gas that filled the inside would have been pumped to a higher energy level, and then microwave frequencies entering through the northern shaft, which resembled a waveguide, could have been gathered on the outside, funneled into the down the shaft, and then as it crossed the chamber, it stimulated emission in an excited hydrogen atmosphere, and then that energy was directed to the southern shaft, which, by the way, has an opening that resembles a horn antenna, what you would see normally recognize as a horn antenna for microwaves, and then directed through the southern shaft to the outside. But it seems that everything seems to point to that that the hydrogen has been generated because of the features within the Queen's Chamber, plus the characteristics of the northern shaft and the resemblance of the northern shaft to a waveguide.
Chris, you know, I wish we had more time. We're almost out of time here. Tell folks your website so they can go and personally experience
it. The website is www.gizapower.com. And on the website, you'll find there are several articles. There is a lot of photographs of what I consider to be machined granite at Giza and other places. There is an article, Advanced Machining in Ancient Egypt, which was originally published in 1984. This has been modified since then. And then some of the of what we talked about tonight in greater detail on the famous Gantenbrink's Door and the exploration by Zahir Hawass in the year 2002.
Okay, well, I wish we had more time. Chris, we're out of time. If you will, stay on the phone with me for a moment, and I want to chat with you after the show. Ladies and gentlemen, we've got a week lined up for you that's absolutely home runs every night. You want to be sure and be here. My friends call me Steeleye. My enemies do, too. You can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.